911, what's your emergency?
Is help coming?
Girl, you picked the wrong day to call 911.
I'm obsessed that this is how I know our podcast is niche, because that's become a running bit on our show.
Yeah, even if we like get to the point where we have followers who aren't just people coming over from my YouTube channel, I'm assuming that if they listen to the other episodes, they'll have context, but maybe they don't, and that's fine.
And they just don't know about Vivica A. Fox and the Lifetime Wrong
they just think we're being really corny for no reason.
Which, Vivica, in fairness, if you're listening, we often are.
Vivica A. Fox, if you're listening, please guest on our podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just be careful, because you don't want to pick the wrong episode to guest on.
Or the wrong 911 recap podcast. Just kidding. We don't have beef with any other 911 recap podcasts.
Yet.
We should manufacture some drama to boost all of our views.
Could you imagine, like, we DM them behind the scenes, like, okay, so this is how our feud's gonna go.
Well, do you remember that episode of iCarly where they meet Fred and they, like, start fake beefing with Fred?
Yes. Yes.
Like he starts fake beef with him, and then they like show up ready to hash it out. And he's like, oh yeah, I was just doing that for views or something. today we're talking about a fun little episode called Help Is Not Coming.
I love this as a title.
I love the drama of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've got the same creative team as the previous episode, written once again by Zachary, writer, we're not sure. Mm-hmm. This one I think was co-written by Tim Minear, which I think is maybe different from the last one. And this is our part two of a two-part episode. So this is kind of interesting, like for us picking up a week later, even though this episode takes place like directly after the events of the last one.
Yeah, this is our first time doing like a two-parter like this, or I guess kind of a three-parter, depending on how you want to slice it. But I like this because I was jumping into, excuse me, I keep burping. I need to stop drinking Diet Coke when we record these. I liked that we could just jump right back into the action, and it felt like we weren't wasting any time. I was sitting down to watch this, and the episode felt like it just like went by like that. You know, because like we were already in it. That's what I like about these part twos. I don't know. So if we had an awkward start to this episode, it's because we had like a 45-minute tangent that ended in a discussion of the Quiet on Set documentary from like multiple months ago.
Let's just not even get into it. Ryan, I was just editing our second episode of this season, and I was thinking about how, for all you listeners out there, you know, Ryan edits the odd numbered episodes and I edit the even numbered episodes, and for some reason, all the ones that Ryan edits, we tend to be like the most rambly. So I feel bad that every time he ends up having to edit the rambly ones. So I want to try and stay on track.
We've only been recording for 20 minutes. It's not that bad so far. I honestly like cutting out some of the rambles at the top, because then I get to see the bar just get shorter. And like, I like that.
True. Okay. But anyway, we open with a little montage of the destruction of the earthquake, with news reporting in the background. Most of this footage appears to be like stock footage and or like real life disaster footage, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. It's like all is devastation around LA, and they had a lot to work with because of like the actual earthquakes that happened in the area.
Right.
And like, you can't really copyright news footage, I guess. So like,
right. Probably a lot of it is open source, and it does make sense in terms of like, yeah, it's a lot cheaper to just get existing disaster footage than shoot all of this stuff. At the same time, I was like, is it insensitive to use real life disaster footage for your TV show about a big sensational earthquake? I don't know.
It's a Ryan Murphy production. I mean, true. On the scale of like, you know, like his greatest crimes, this is probably like a 2, you know.
You're right.
But like, I about this montage, they're playing the credits music, like the intense credits music over the beginning. I just have to ask.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just me, but like, I always felt like that music was kind of weird. Because it doesn't really feel like the tone of the rest of the show. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, it's not very good score music. And I did notice there was like a scene in season one, I think, where they used it like in the background as score, which I feel like you don't hear anymore in the later seasons. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Because you're right. It sounds it sounds apt as like a credits music thing. It doesn't sound as good as score.
It sounds like NCIS music a little bit. It sounds like
it does.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, it's the most like network procedural thing about this. If you think about this show, it's kind of weird. This is kind of a weird show.
If you think about it.
No, I'm being honest. Like, it is kind of a weird show. I mean, this show is basically a sitcom set in, like, you know, a firehouse. But they're also, like, it's has the most traumatic shit you've ever seen in your life. Like, sandwich in between. Like, it's kind of a weird beast. Because, like...
It does stand out a little bit among other... Among its contemporaries.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't really a procedural like it on the air. Because, like, if anything, it feels more like... I don't know. It's like they took, like, these common tropes of, like... The procedural, so like cops, firefighters, you know, etc., EMTs, that sort of thing. And then they subbed it into this like Ryan Murphy TV show like archetype, like sort of like an American Horror Story
really exaggerated style.
And even just like the template for the show, like the between 10 and 18 episodes per season, like it's got this like a very particular like vibe to it. Because like you think about like contrasting the show with something like SVU, and I think I've talked about this before, but SVU feels very like grounded, and it's like sort of like dated 90s gritty New Yorkness. And like,
yeah, I mentioned that in my video, and I had people commenting like, come on, SVU isn't gritty and realistic. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's not literally realistic, but like the style is like gritty New York, like everyday, more like boots on the ground, like cop stuff.
Yeah, they're going for something grounded with it. The last show I can think of that was like this brand of like sensational and almost like campy, and it's it has this sort of like camp aesthetic and like kind of a appeal to it, is like maybe Bones, because Bones was very over the top. Bones is a very over the top show, actually. You know?
Because I was also trying to think of like, are there any shows like this that are like this level of campy? And I think Bones did, like, compared to its contemporaries, have kind of a lot more humor.
Yeah.
Even if it did also have like the seriousness and the melodrama at times. Yeah, I was also kind of thinking Grey's Anatomy, because even though Grey's Anatomy can be a very like dour show at times, I feel like it also is a little more unserious than some of its contemporaries.
Oh yeah. Compare like Grey's Anatomy to like Chicago Med or something like that, you know. Like one of the Dick Wolf
shows. I wouldn't know, because I've never watched Chicago Med, but whenever I turn to that one, it always feels like the boring one.
It is the boring one. I don't know. I mean, like, there are, like, I mean, I have, like, sampled the medical drama pretty widely, and, like, Grey's is definitely, like, probably the campiest, and I think a big part of that is just that, like, these shows focus so much on, like, relationships and, like, the personal lives of, you know, the characters and everything, and, like, their personal drama, whereas, like, a lot of shows like NCIS or, you know, the Chicago shows or whatever... they're more so like the characters, a lot of their stuff tends to happen in like the margins of the story.
Well, I was thinking with Grey's though, like more like the medical stuff specifically, I feel like is really campy on that show. Like I feel like part of their mission was like, oh, we're gonna go for the craziest, like most sensational medical stuff. I don't know, I've got all these images flashing in my mind of like the two people impaled on the same pole, the bomb that's going to go off inside the person's body, the guy that shows up with this crazy type of skin condition where he's got like a spider living in all these like weird plaques on him. So yeah,
you're reminding me why I need to get back into that show, because I love that show so much.
Oh, it's great.
I've been thinking maybe I should just rewatch the first 5 seasons or something. All the ones with George. I love George.
The first, listen, the first like 12 to 13 seasons are great. Then it falls off for a minute in like seasons 14, 15. But then I remember it really coming back in like 16 or 17. No, not 17, because I think that was the COVID season and that one kind of sucked. But I think 15 and 16 were pretty good. The last 2 seasons have not been hitting for me. I don't know if it's because Meredith isn't on it very much, but it just like the character drama just feels surface level, like it's not hitting for me.
Do you think Ellen Pompeo still enjoys working on that show?
Well, she's barely on it. She just does like voiceover now, and I think she is supposed to be like leaving this season.
She's been like, she's been soft leaving. Oh, she's leaving part 2 for good.
I was going to say, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry we're getting so off track. We're literally still on the first 30 seconds of the show. Okay, so
I have something else to say.
Okay,
naming your part 2 of a musical after the climactic 11 o'clock number from that musical is kind of crazy if you think about it. It's like,
it is.
It's like if they made 2 Gypsy movies and the second one was called Gypsy see Rose's turn or something like that. Like, it's ridiculous. Isn't that a ridiculous naming convention? I'm sorry.
Tick, tick, boom. What's that song called?
I hate that show.
Actions speak louder than words. I don't even know. I've never seen the musical. I just know some of the songs.
In the Heights, Paciencia y Fe. Like, I don't know. It's like...
It would be In the Heights. What's 96,000?
96,000. 96,000.
In the Heights Part 2. In the Heights Part 2. Carnaval del Barrio.
Hamilton Part 2. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? And it just becomes an 11-word title. Like, even though they could have just called it Hamilton.
No, okay. Prediction for, like, the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. John M. Chu will be hired to direct the film adaptation of Hamilton. He's going to split it up into 5 parts, like James Cameron's Avatar. Hamilton Part 1, My Shot. Hamilton Part 2, Satisfied. Or maybe, like, to do a twist on it, they'll call it Unsatisfied. And mm-hmm. it focuses on Angelica. Hamilton Part 3, what are even the songs in Hamilton? The World Turned Upside Down.
Right.
Hamilton Part 4.
Burn, or something like that.
Burn. Yeah. Hamilton Part 5, Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story.
Right.
But you have to make it as wordy as possible. So it's like Hamilton Part 5, The Squeakquel, Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story, For Good, The Final Chapter.
My question is just like, what obscure historical figure are they going to get Lin-Manuel to cameo as in all 5 films?
Ooh.
And maybe probably do a solo that's like an original for the movie. Maybe, oh, you know what? He would probably do John Adams, because there's no John Adams
John
in that
Adams.
Show. Because I don't know if you remember, but like he was a big fan of the musical 1776. And like, and so his version of John Adams is just the John Adams from that show, which is why there's no John Adams in Hamilton.
Mm. And as like an Easter egg, he performs a song from 1776, but like the
exactly.
Lin-Manuel remix,
exactly
with a rap breakdown.
Yeah, and they're like rhyming like the second word of every sentence. Meanwhile, he's doing brother and brother and brother and brother and brother every line.
Hollywood needs to hire us because we are spitting right now.
Can I be honest?
This would make so much money.
I know it would make money, but also, like, if this was made, I would probably just, like, walk out into the snow and let nature reclaim me.
Oh, no, it would be... I'm not saying it would be good. I'm just saying, like, the Hollywood executives would love us for this.
How into Hamilton do you think the average American still is?
I think most people, not very much, but a very small contingency of, like, chronically online Tumblr people and really, like, lib... you know, Obama era liberals are still, they would see it 50 times in theaters. Each of the 5 parts.
Is Hamilton fandom still a thing? Are they still doing like Miku
Probably.
Binder illustrations?
I have a hard time believing that it could have completely died out. So I'm going to say yes.
I don't know, man. I mean, like, I guess, but I don't know how, first of all, okay, this might be a hot take. I don't know how Hamilton got as popular as it did, because in my opinion, Lin-Manuel Miranda is not a great writer.
Well, okay, I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. I think he's good, and I think Hamilton is good. It got annoyingly popular, and there are valid criticisms of the way it handles history and whatever, but I think it did get popular because it is a pretty objectively great piece of art. And that's how Jane sees it.
And that's how Jane sees it. No, respect, honestly. Like, it is like a good piece of art. I'm not lying about that. I'm not trying to be so different. I don't know. It didn't hit for me. Because I thought the music was corny, and I think Lin-Manuel's corny, and I don't think he's a good performer.
Oh, he is, but I think he's not a great performer,
no,
but he's a good writer.
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't know, I get...
He's like
Taylor
Swift.
Well, the thing is, okay...
And maybe that's why you don't like him.
Yeah, exactly, because, like, Lin-Manuel, the reason he started writing so many of these shows is because no one would cast him, because he's not, like, a good vocalist, he's not a good dancer, he's not really a good rapper. He's not a great actor. I hope he never listens to this podcast. I hope the fuck he does. I would tell this to him to his face. He annoys me.
Lin-Manuel Miranda is listening to this podcast episode right now, and he's like sobbing into his pillow.
I'm sorry, Lin-Manuel.
His Thomas Jefferson pillow.
One of the people who talks about 911 on your favorite podcast hates you. Sorry. Get that Disney bag. I hope Moana 2 was worth it.
I hope Mufasa, the Lion King story, was worth it.
Did he do the music for that?
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh,
have you seen?
Man.
There's been a clip going around of like, I haven't seen it, so I don't mean to judge the whole thing based on my brother.
My brother.
That's not a straight up my brother. Why did he say it like that? Let's get back to the point of this podcast, which is to recap episodes of 911 in a humorous and interesting and endearing manner. So after this little montage, after this little montage, we cut to Maddie at the dispatch, I say, 40 minutes into our recording session.
Maddie's at the dispatch, and she's telling, she has to tell, presumably a man, that martial law has not been declared, and that he doesn't, and that California doesn't really have a stand your ground law, so he can't just start killing people.
Do you think this is the same guy who accidentally shot himself with a grenade launcher in episode one?
It might be. If anything, I think it might be a precursor to the grocery store owner that we see later on in the episode.
Oh. Could be. That would be a fun Easter egg. Yeah. Well, she also, she is on another call with a lady where she's like, sorry, ma'am, but we can't send a squad car to go help find your missing cat. Try leaving out a can of tuna. And I felt for the woman with the missing cat, because I would also be sad if my cat ran away during an earthquake.
I think we'd all be sad, but like, what do you call 911?
I wouldn't, but I just like, I'm just putting my empathy out there for the lady with the missing cat. I hope this fictional woman found her cat.
I hope she did too. We'll send her our prayers. We'll send the prayers to the fictional cat lady.
Yes, thoughts and prayers to the missing cat.
Yeah.
She gets another call, this one more serious, from somebody, well, Josh comes over, I think, and
yeah, she's getting
like,
a little overwhelmed.
But he says, you know, just keep going, keep fielding the nonsense calls, and you know, send us any more serious ones, help where you can. She gets a call from somebody saying, my wife just went into labor, we can't get to the hospital. And Maddie's keeping very cool about it. She's like, I'm a nurse, I can talk you through it. And he's like, no, you can't. My wife is unconscious. Like, she got knocked unconscious during the earthquake. So,
yeah, there was an aftershock. We were going to the hospital because the baby was coming. It's like, this is complicated. Like, and she's unconscious. And, like, I need help. I need help. And she goes, it's not coming. Help is not coming.
Help is not coming. The title of the episode.
You know?
But again, so dramatic. I love the drama.
So
of
dramatic.
Help is not coming.
So good. And what a great, what great material to give Jennifer on her first,
seriously,
presumably like her first couple of weeks on the show. And it's like, okay, we want to like start Maddie off with a bang here and like really establish her as a strong character right at the gate. And she uses her nursing skills to, I guess, like help this guy with some sort of immediate medical aid for his wife.
Get her on her side, keep her airway open.
And then she and Josh start collaborating because, like, obviously, like, you know, she's unconscious. This is a medical emergency. She needs to go to the hospital. And so they start, I guess, like, trying to plan routes to, like, get them there. But all of the, you know, roads are jammed. There's traffic. There's accidents. Mm-hmm. There's pileups. There's everything. And so they can't really get to a hospital. But what they can do is get the family to some first responders who are responding to something else.
She has a great line where she's like, if we can't get the first responders to them, let's get them to the first responders. And you're like, oh yeah. So she has them go to a fire where some firefighters are putting out a fire, and they're like, we're sending a woman in labor to you.
Can we take a moment to appreciate, how many episodes has it been since we've seen firefighters fighting actual fires?
I had this same exact thought. I was like, oh, shit, that's what they're supposed to be doing.
And of course, it's the 125, right? It's not like the
it's not the
118 doing this.
Which, to be fair, I've read that something like as much as like 50% or even more than that of like fire calls that fire and rescue respond to are not fires. Like, I think probably their most common thing is like car related accidents, so it's not necessarily unrealistic for them to not constantly be fighting fires. But yeah, there's a difference between like not constantly fighting fires and literally almost
never
responding
fires
to the scene of a fire.
I mean, they're firefighters. I don't know, I guess maybe that's just what they do between
it's
episodes.
In the name.
It's what they do between episodes, because we did see in episode two or whatever it was when Abby was calling Buck for the first time and he was fighting fires,
right?
And I think that was the first time. That was the last time we saw Buck fighting a fire up until now. I don't think we've seen Buck fighting a fire since then.
Yeah, and you'd think on this show that they would put out more forest fires because, you know, California is kind of known for that. Yeah.
Only everyone except the 118 can stop forest fires.
You know, yeah, we can just assume that all of the firefighting happens off screen in between what we're seeing in the episodes.
Exactly.
But, you know, she gets that. She gets what she calls a miracle. And it's like, wow, Maddie's pretty good at this dispatch thing. And then we get our first, first occurrence of Maddie crying while slash after responding to a 911 call.
Yeah.
Which I think is funny because that's one of my drinking game rules for this show. It happens almost every time Maddie takes a 911 call.
When is she going to cry during this one? When is she going to cry during
this one? It's like specifically like after hanging up a call and then like having to like pull herself together and take the next call is like such a common Maddie thing on this show.
She takes a breath, sheds a single tear, and then steals herself and then says, 911, what's your emergency? And then like, she just keeps going.
Wow, what a strong woman.
A strong woman.
But yeah, I was enjoying like in this scene how, you know, our first episode in this two-parter was very much like the acute disaster, the big flashy stuff. And now this episode is going to be more about the aftermath and some of the like logistics of these rescues, which I found kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's like kind of like the crisis, like the early crisis, like the immediate crisis is like it's over. And now it's like moving on to like sort of like the ongoing sort of state of emergency as they work to rescue as many people as they can. And it kind of...
Right.
I'm editing
Ryan's
this.
On his second Diet Coke
I'm on
of
my
this,
second Diet Coke
session.
Of the episode. Even though a lot of it stays localized to the hotel, the field of the parts of the cities they're sort of exploring this sort of disaster scenario in are going to expand a little bit. Like, you know, we see Athena at that grocery store. We see more like stuff with like Michael at home with the kids and everything and like going to the church and all that. And they still like stay at the hotel, but then you also have Maddie answering calls and, you know, it feels like we're getting more of like a broad scope sort of LA thing rather than last episode, which felt very contained.
And it's fun to see all those kind of rippling effects of this disaster happening around town. So then we go back to our hotel location, I think. The incident commander, this like female firefighter, is kind of commanding everything. And the dad of the missing little girl is still really pestering everybody. Like, we haven't heard anything about our daughter. You can understand both sides because, like, obviously from the firefighter's point of view, they can't do anything more than what they're doing. But, you know, for the dad, obviously, he's not hearing a lot.
But, like, this lady, I mean, like the captain, the fire captain, she, like, hates this guy. You can just tell.
She's like, it's going to be a long day.
you can just tell she's already so fed up with them. I mean, they've had 16 aftershocks, one measured up to like a 4.9 on the Richter scale. Like,
she's like, fuck you. Fuck your missing daughter. I could not care less.
This guy's the worst. I hate this guy. You know, like, like as I do with every table at my restaurant, I'm always like talking about the people that I have to deal with at my job. So I get her.
Yeah, you know.
I get her. Honestly, I feel for her more than this guy. Like, yeah, you may have lost your daughter, but she's having a long day on the job right now.
She's a service worker, okay?
Yes. She's an essential worker.
Right. We then go to in the collapsed building, Bobby and Chimney are looking for Hen. As we know, right at the end of the last episode, they got separated by one of the aftershocks. Hen is... she kind of wakes up under the rubble. I think she's in there, isolated from the others.
She's in this little pocket, right? When a lot of the stuff collapsed after the last aftershock, it created this little pocket that was in the garage in one of the sublevels that separated Hen from the rest of the squad. And so now there's like concrete between them. And it's like, it's almost like 9/11-y the way she's like trapped under the rubble and having to sort of dig her way out a little bit.
This lady hates
this guy. Hen's trapped under the rubble of the Twin Towers. And meanwhile, up in the Leaning Tower of LA, Allie and Buck kind of have a vibe a little bit.
They're kind of picking up a vibe. Eddie is there too. But yeah, it is kind of the Buck and Allie show right now. We hear that Allie went to RISD, which I thought was a fun detail. She mentions the Rhode Island School of Design, which I only know because when I was a kid in arts high school, it was one of my colleges I was considering.
Mm-hmm.
So good for her.
Good for her.
I think that emphasizes what you thought in the previous episode that she was a, you assumed she was an architect. That's probably right if she went to a design school.
Yeah. So they're leading her sort of to safety, like in that like crooked stairwell that we saw them going up earlier.
It's like the stairwell of this tilted building, so it's kind of treacherous.
It seems super cumbersome to get down. Obviously she's injured too, so like it's not easy. They get down to like where they got in, and because of the aftershock, the little opening that they had caved in, and so they can't get out that way.
So Eddie's like, I guess we'll go back up, find another way. I'm so sorry, but I have to say, in the credits I noticed co-executive producer Lara Azzopardi. Now, I recognize that name. That was one of the co-showrunners of the canceled Degrassi reboot.
Oh.
Just a little... I don't really have anything to say about that. Like, it doesn't mean anything. But, you know, crossover.
You mean your fallen child, the canceled Degrassi reboot at HBO Max?
Yeah.
I remember when...
Sorry, Lara, that didn't work out for you.
I remember when the news of that show's cancellation, like, came out, and I was like, oh my god, this is gonna be devastating for Jane specifically, and then I rushed to your Twitter, and, like, you're, like, posting that, like, that gif from, like, How to Get Away with Murder, where she's, like, Viola Davis is, like, shaking, like, Bonnie, the blonde woman. And it's like, no, 911 Degrassi, HBO Degrassi reboot, stay with me.
Yeah, it was a tragic day for us all. But, you know, I still have faith that one day there will be a different Degrassi reboot that will get off the ground.
Do you think they'll bring back Spike and Snake?
I don't know, and I don't really care at this point. I just want it to happen. I don't care if they bring back any original people.
I agree. I think it should follow the daughter of Holly J. I was just gonna say that because they do like the sound off on the radio after the aftershock. Mm-hmm. They're like head count. You know, Hen doesn't check in, right? And like Eddie's face, like you see, he's very disturbed by this. And I'm just thinking, wow.
Even though he's known Hen for like a week.
Right. No, literally. But I'm just thinking he's getting like Dead Army flashbacks or something. Like,
ooh,
he,
could
like,
be.
Maybe Eddie's having a little PTSD moment, and he's like, no, could not be. Another fallen comrade. But then we cut to Hen down in the rubble.
Hen is alive.
And she's alive.
Hen did not die. She's under the rubble, and she finds another firefighter, Russ, who's different.
He's with the 221, who were like responding on the scene with the 118.
Yeah, he is severely injured. They're talking to each other. She finds out Russ actually came in on his day off, so this especially unfortunate.
He picked the wrong day to come in.
He picked the wrong day to show up to work. He reveals that he says he came in on his day off, and he's like, you know, nothing new on Netflix, which I was like, is that like Netflix shade? Because this show doesn't air on Netflix. I don't know.
I thought, what an interesting intentionality to ascribe to these writers.
Well, I mean, they can't just say like nothing new on Hulu because that's their streaming partner.
Yeah, that would be like very obvious like brand association.
Except they couldn't say that. They'd have to say, despite all the new and interesting offerings on Hulu, I decided to come into work anyway.
I just loved the like jumping to Netflix shade as like, you remember like the Claro shade meme from last year?
I do.
Yeah,
I do, because of you.
Did y'all catch the Netflix shade?
Anyway, I wrote down in my notes, am I crazy or does the Russ actor kind of look like Bobby? Did you notice this?
I didn't necessarily notice him looking like Bobby per se. There was a different middle-aged white man that he looked like that I'm having trouble placing right now. Huh. But I feel like it would probably... Okay, no, hold on. My brain just... I just had a stroke, I swear to God, because I was going to compare him to, like, some other, like, middle-aged guy. And the first thing that I thought of... The first thing that I thought of was the guy from 6 Feet Under. You know, character actor Peter Krause.
Oh, yeah, that guy. Who looks nothing like Bobby. Okay, so we're in agreement on this.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Oh, he looks like Bobby.
Because, I don't know, it was something about, like, the angle they were filming him from. He just looked a little bit like a young Peter Krause, so that was interesting.
Yeah.
And maybe Peter Krause is younger. Maybe it's symbolic.
He was younger on 6 Feet Under, too, so...
Exactly. Maybe it was symbolic, like this guy dying in front of Hen is like reminding her of her team. But that's definitely reading too much into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's trying to convince him, like, no, we're going to get you out of here. And he's doing that thing where he's like, no, yeah. I know I'm dying. I've got a flail chest. My lungs collapsed.
He's got a fractured pelvis. Saying. He's got a column that like fell on him or something. He's being pinned by like a stone column or something.
And so he has a line. He says, help's not coming. And you're pointing to the screen like Leonardo DiCaprio. You're like, hey, that's the name of the episode.
That's the episode. That's what we're watching. It's almost like, wow, would he say this guy, under all this rubble is a little trapped?
At various points throughout this episode, was pondering the nature of these characters' trappedness.
Trapped. And, yeah, they're all trapped.
I would agree with you that he's trapped in this moment. Mm-hmm. And you could argue that he's even trapped both physically and metaphorically.
Yeah. No, yeah, he is.
He's like, give me some morphine. Hen's preparing to do that, but she's like, you know, we're not giving up. We're gonna get you out of here.
He notices her wedding ring, and he's like, so you got a husband or something? Or like, well, I don't remember what his exact line was, but it was like to the effect
of
like,
yeah. She says yes. Mm-hmm. He asks if she's married, and she says yes, and he assumes husband. She's like, no, wife. And he's like, I used to have one of those. And he starts like sadly reflecting on his life, and then he dies.
And then he dies. Right, it's like. It's like this really strange sort of like devastating scene where like this guy dies, and like it's just like one of those things where like there's nothing you can do about it, and you feel so bad for this guy, and then you feel bad for Hen too,
because she's the human toll of this earthquake. Ryan,
I know, but I'm just like, imagine being that guy in that scenario where like there's nothing you can do to stop your own death, so then you just sadly reflect on your own life, and then you just die in front of this person.
Well, I mean, I think that's how a lot of people die.
I know. That's just sad to think about.
Yeah.
Nutty Putty Cave be damned, you know?
You know, Hen's sad. And then we cut to Michael with the kids.
Yes. Yes.
He's at home.
He is doing, like, yard work, just basically, like, getting the outside of the house back into shape because, like, there was an earthquake and he had to check
there
for
was a
damage.
Giant earthquake.
It's like, is the sprinkler system okay? Is, like, the integrity of, like, the fence and the roof intact, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, inside, Harry and May are just watching the news. They're just watching the news.
You know, Michael's like, you guys, I told you to clean up this mess of like all our stuff that fell off all the shelves when the earthquake hit. And the kids are like, well, no, we wanted to watch the news. Yeah. And, you know, clearly they're worried about their mom because they haven't been able to get a hold of Athena. And they're just, I think, understandably, they're just kind of distracted by this giant natural disaster they just witnessed in their town. They're kind of not feeling like they can just get back to their normal routine. Yeah. So,
and you get the sense
Michael's
that, like,
mad at them.
Yeah, you get the sense that Michael's trying to like distract them from it in a sense by like having them do this work in the house to like sort of take their mind off of it. He's trying to, I guess, be mindful of his kids in that sense. And Harry says the craziest thing, which is he goes, why do you care more about those books than you care about mom?
I got where the kids were coming from, though. I got like, well, to be honest, part of it was just a childish impulse of mine where I looked at the mess on the floor and I was like, you know what? I wouldn't want to clean that shit up either. I would like go pretend to fall asleep so that my parents could do it. I'm just kidding. I'm not a spoiled child. But I was looking at that and I was like, if I were like 10, I would definitely not want to do that. But I get where Harry's coming from. He's really worried about his mom and he's like, how do you expect us to clean? From his perspective, he feels like his dad is like, just doesn't even care about Athena. But Michael sort of defends himself and is like, hey, I've been worrying about your mom since before you were born. You know, she always risks her life on her job and we've just got to know that she can defend herself. Yeah. And
it sounds like he's learned to compartmentalize in a sense, in a way that they haven't. And so he has sort of been, I guess, acting on that without really sort of, I guess, taking into account that this might be one of the first times that they've really had their mom go out into the field and had this experience where, like, we're not sure if she's coming back, even though he's been through that before and he knows how to deal with it.
Right.
And so having
May
this...
says, yeah. understandably, mm-hmm. she's like, well, this isn't just like any other day. Like, this is unique circumstances, which is true.
And so in order to, I guess, sort of meet them where they are, he has them grab their shit and they hit the road and they're going to go do something together, the three of them. To sort of, I guess, mm-hmm. get out of this sort of, I guess, spiraling well of anxiety that they've found themselves in. Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess nobody's going to clean up the mess.
Yeah, that mess is going to remain uncleaned.
Yeah, Athena's going to come home to that mess. Yeah. So,
but in the meantime, she has her hands full because mm-hmm. there's a 911 call. There's this guy. He's like, 911. These people are like animals. He shoots his gun. He's like,
They're looting my store.
And she rolls up.
We hear a gunshot.
Athena rolls up with her squad car. And she walks into the store. Basically, there's this crowd of people outside. They're very angry. And the store owner has like a shotgun in his hands. that he just has. America, I keep forgetting sometimes, but then I remember.
Yep. Basically, the point of this scene is Athena... It's kind of one of Athena's, like, righteous speech moments, yeah. like when she arrests all the people on the plane.
Yeah.
But she's definitely in the right. As Athena finds out when she comes in, these people are not even looting the store. They have been attempting to pay for stuff, and this guy is price gouging.
Yeah.
You know, Athena asks somebody what he was charging her for.
Like a case
of water,
bottles.
She's like,
$100. Yeah. $100.
So massively...
He lies and tries to say, oh, it's like $14.99 in the lady comes in, she's like, that's a goddamn lie. $100 for a case of water bottles.
Yes.
And then he says,
so Athena.
He tries to spin mm-hmm. it. Okay, he tries to spin it because he's like, well, if I charge them at regular prices, or I only go up by 10%, then like three people are going to buy everything. So I'm just doing this to give everyone a fair chance, which is a very American jingoistic right. sort of like thing to say. Like, we're
masterful gambit,
we're
sir.
Making things harder for everyone. So everyone technically on paper has a chance. Meanwhile, he's just doing it so he can squeeze
this
as much money
market.
Out of these people as he possibly can.
It's wild.
It's really effective at getting you to hate this guy and getting you on Athena's side.
It is. It's ineffective because, like, everybody hates price gouging. Mm-hmm. Everybody, I think, normal people, like I said, like, even when people are looting in times of natural disaster, I think a lot of normal people do side with the looters because, again, it's like,
yeah.
often people are quote-unquote looting just because they need access to basic supplies. But in this case, yeah, everybody hates a price gouger. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these people need things like water and supplies, and this guy's keeping them from him. So Athena, as Athena always does, you know, instantly clocks who's in the right and who's mm-hmm. in the wrong here, mm-hmm. and gives her righteous speech to this guy. She talks about, like, did you know about whatever law this that says that people are only allowed to raise prices up to 10% in when there's a state of emergency, mm-hmm. and, you know, a state of emergency was declared today. And she's like, how about instead of arresting you, we can come up with a different arrangement? And he's like what? She says, you tell me. And this leads to him, like, just, you know, slowly.
I'll
only raise it 10%. And yeah. Athena, like, starts reaching for her handcuffs.
And then he's like, 10% off?
She's like, 20, still doing it. 20%? He's like, 20% off.
And then he's like,
okay, 50% off.
Everything
and she's
in
like,
this
That's
store.
More like it.
and then she goes to the door and she's like, guess what, folks? Half off day. And everybody
like, wow.
clapped.
She's like Batman.
Yeah.
She's the people's. She's the vigilante mm-hmm. they deserve.
And to cap it all off, she buys a candy bar and puts 50 cents down on the counter and says,
yep.
thank you for your business. Walks
Pretty
out with
iconic.
The candy bar.
Obviously, morally, she's in the right here, but I love how she just does something that, like, legally, he had no requirement to lower his prices that much. But she's just like, you know what? I'm going to abuse my authority for good today.
Yeah.
And
finally,
I respect
finally.
That.
We're glad she's finally doing it. But honestly, like, I hated this guy so much, and, like, this is obviously the intended effect, that, like, she could have, like, mm-hmm. just fully police brutalized this guy, and I would have been on her side. She could have pistol-whipped the fuck out of this guy, and I would have just been like, thank God, finally aiming it at someone who deserves it, which is definitely a character flaw in my sense that I jump there.
But we all have these thoughts sometimes while watching TV.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, 50% yeah, off, it's a good way to wrap that up. And a good moment right. for Athena, too. Good eye yeah. acting from Angela Bassett in this scene.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I think mm-hmm. we go back to the dispatch. Mm-hmm. And Maddie, we've got like an LAFD representative has shown up, and Maddie's asking him about the 118.
Yep.
He doesn't know anything. So she tries texting Buck. She's really worried about Buck this whole episode, and he doesn't reply. And then we cut back to him and Eddie and Allie making their way down the stairs. Yeah. I thought this was funny that for once, Buck is not answering his phone yeah. while on the job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was like, remember in season one when he would literally drop everything no matter where he was?
It takes literal like cell towers being knocked out for him to like, it takes the infrastructure going down for him to stop taking calls on the job.
Maybe he like made a pledge this year that he's like, you know what, I'm gonna be a better firefighter, I'm gonna stop taking mm-hmm. calls in the middle of responding to calls.
If I'm just the best firefighter in the world, if I'm just the goodest boy, one day Abby will come back to me.
Yeah.
No, but I just have to ask
speaking
this,
of which
I have to ask this uh-huh. Because I know where you're going. I have to very quickly, because I know you're of a filmmaking background, and I want your perspective on this. Is it tacky to show the text message on this screen when a character is texting?
Well, first of all, this is subjective, so don't take my bachelor's degree in film opinion as gospel.
Sure.
But I would say it depends on the situation. I think it can be corny, but I also think, obviously, filmmakers struggle with how to depict text messages. I think I tend to prefer showing the screen itself, like mm-hmm. just filming the screen.
Yeah.
But I think especially in a TV show like this, like I'm not going to take points off just for showing the texts in a graphic on screen. I don't think it's inherently tacky. It sometimes it's done in a stupid way, like on the show Sherlock, but I think it
oh my god. No, Sherlock was like the ultimate in like, because you could tell, like, the way they did it, they thought they were being, like, very, like, high concept about it, too.
Uh-huh.
Do you, like the way that they would just, like, show him, like, a savant style, like, just moving through images in his head and everything. It's honestly, yeah. like, it was really embarrassing to watch.
We can't go on any other tangents in this episode.
No, we can't. We can't keep doing that.
But speaking of Buck always answering the phone for Abby, there's yeah. a very embarrassing moment in this scene
yeah.
where, you know, Buck, Allie, and Eddie are still making their way through the hotel, and Buck accidentally calls Allie, Abby. She's like, my name is Allie. And Eddie doesn't say anything in response to this whole thing, but if I were Eddie, I would be rolling my eyes so hard. If you hear your coworker who you just met, who like the one of the only things you know about him at this point, as we know from episode one, is that according to you, his girlfriend broke up with him recently. And I would just be like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing for him. But sadly,
yeah.
we don't get to see Eddie's reaction.
No, you're absolutely right about that. It's like the Freudian slip to end all Freudian slips. And mm-hmm. Also very revealing on the part of the writers that like, it's like the clearest of like signs you could give that like, oh, they're setting up a little thing here or something like that. I actually don't.
Right. He's associating Allie and Abby in his mind.
I like this trio. I like the three of them together. I like Allie as a character.
I do too. You know? I like Allie. She was working for me. I like for example, in this scene, they're like going down one of the hallways in the hotel and she finds like a staff cart that's carrying like mini bar items. It's yeah. got all these little mini bottles of liquor, and so she just starts
plucks like a bottle of vodka off of there.
Yeah. And Buck and Eddie kind of look at her funny, and she's like, what, it's after 5 p.m like I liked obviously we don't get to know her that intimately in this episode, but yeah. I like the little character things they give her were yeah. fun. She seems like a fun lady.
Yeah, and her actor is very charismatic too. Like I was she was really selling it for me. I was feeling her, and I remember feeling mm-hmm. her when I was first watching this. this like years ago. I'm like, oh, I hope Allie sticks around. Wink, wink. But
but then they hear, as this is happening, they're like trying to find another way out, and they hear someone calling out for help from one of the rooms. So yes. They go in. There's like an employee, I think, who has suffered some kind of injury.
Was he an employee, or was he staying in the room? He
could have been.
He might be.
For some reason, when I saw him, I thought he was like in a uniform or something, but maybe that's not right.
Okay. I mean, that would make sense if he was like cleaning the room or something like that. I just assumed that he was staying in it, but I could be wrong.
They did say it was checkout, so he could have been cleaning the room for the next person.
Yeah. But he was in the room when the earthquake hit. He got pinned by like what appeared to be like a roller chair or something like that.
Right.
And
they start helping him, and he says he soiled himself, which at first I was like, why would you say that? But they're setting up that he seemingly has a spinal injury, because that can happen sometimes when people injure their spines. They lose bladder control.
Yeah, he has numbness in his legs as well. And so it's just like, okay, everything below the waist is kind of fucked for this guy right now.
Buck and Eddie, I was enjoying like Buck slides to the other end of the room because the whole thing is tilted. And then Eddie, after like determining that this guy might have a spinal injury, like also slides across the room, I think just to go be closer to Buck so that they can talk in private, which I just thought was like a funny thing for him to do by sliding across this tilted floor. But you know, they start more privately saying like, sounds like he's got a spinal injury. Like, what are we going to do? We don't have a backboard. Allie, resourceful queen, is like, can we use this ironing board? And it's like the perfect size. Yeah. So then they're like, how are we going to get him down those stairs? They realize we can use the elevator shaft. Empty elevator shaft.
Yeah. Did you ever see that show L.A. Law?
No.
So there's a very famous scene from that show where one of the women, she is going to walk into the elevator, and she's not looking where she's going, and the door opens and the elevator shaft is empty, and she walks in and she falls to her death. And it's like,
and you said in the episode Trapped that you are like afraid of elevators, right?
Yeah. So that's where a lot of my fear comes from is that episode of LA Law. And so that's all I could fucking think of with this. And so I saw the elevator up there, and keep in mind, I'd already seen the episode, so I knew it was going to happen. But I saw it and I clocked it, and I'm like, that's coming down. That is coming the fuck down.
Yeah. I was thinking of you during that scene because I was like, oh, Ryan would be so freaked out by this.
I absolutely would be. You would not get me to be able to like go within like 5 feet of that like empty elevator shaft. That would not happen ever.
Allie is the only one of the group who seems like kind of freaked out at using the elevator shaft, but Buck and Eddie are like, whatever, I like our odds. But yeah, I guess Allie is the one doing the foreshadowing here. But then we cut to Hen, who's still trying to get out from under the rubble. She's like working really hard and she can't do it.
Yeah.
And she decides to call Karen and leave a message for her. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good, like Aisha Hines acting moment where she just gets to like give this little monologue about like, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it home, but if I don't, know that I fought to get out and stuff and come home to you. And it's like, yes, good actress moment.
A very good actress moment. I was thinking, however, as this was happening, I was thinking to myself, man, we haven't really heard anything about the Eva storyline in like 4 episodes, have we?
No. I think we will get there soon, though, to be fair.
We will. I'm just like thinking all this is happening and like Hen's ex is suing for custody and we haven't heard anything about it. True. Like,
true. I mean, these first few episodes have been pretty like action heavy over character. Although, see, episode one, we got a lot of Buck stuff, so it's not totally fair. But I think, to be fair, I think in the next, like, 2 episodes, we get some good Hen and Chimney stuff on their end.
Yeah. So she records her voice note, for, like, when they find my body or whatever. And then... she gets this surge of, I guess, inspiration, you would call it. And she like continues with her efforts to the point where like she makes like a hole, like
she
a little
gets,
gap,
like, a big rock out of the way.
Yeah, but between
and who should come in?
Car. Precious,
who should come running in.
Precious,
but Paisley.
I know his name is, I know like the dog's name is Paisley. I just kept calling her Precious after the toy poodle from Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill's dog.
Oh, cute.
like Paisley comes up and Hen says, so it's so funny. She goes, Lassie, go get help.
Yeah. Yeah, seemingly just to herself. Like, yeah. She's not actually trying to get the dog to go away. It's just like, need to do a cultural reference here. So she finds this dog. She reads on the collar, like, oh, Paisley, your name is Paisley. And then, sort of like how you can, like, follow the rats on a sinking ship.
Yep.
She's like, show me the way out, Paisley. Because, like, Paisley had to come from somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So... you know, a sprig of hope, a ray of hope.
And she gets free. She goes through the hole that she made. And then we cut back to Michael with the grandchildren, right? He takes them to...
Oh, I thought
to,
you said the grandchildren. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure those are just his kids.
No, the grandchildren.
Yes, the grandchildren.
May and
they
Harry specifically.
Arrive at church.
They go to church, yeah, and they're going to do some sort of like some cert sort of EMT stuff. Did you ever?
There's like a relief effort going on at this church where like people are getting shelter, they're reuniting with their families and whatnot. Yeah. And Michael is like, you know, to like you said, to kind of stave off this anxiety, he's brought them to the church to be of service, as he puts it. They meet up with a woman who's, you know, presumably someone they know who works at their church. I assume they're Baptist, since that's what Athena said she was.
Yeah.
At the end of season one.
It's like,
I don't
it's
know
sort of like,
about
a, it's like
church,
a casual,
but...
like, sort of Protestant type thing. I don't know. I think,
yeah,
I think
it doesn't seem hugely, like, the service they're doing doesn't seem, like, super religious.
It's more community oriented.
Like,
oh,
like a community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like basically like doing like a community center or something like that. But it's just got like sort of a Jesus-y. Framing device or something like that. But
it's a cool church set. It's a nice looking church.
It is a nice looking church. Did your school ever do CERT, community emergency response team classes?
No.
You never did that?
Definitely not.
Yeah, so we had that as an elective option, and so we learned like EMT. We got EMT training while we were in high school. And like, so we learned about triage, and we learned how to like do like those like what do you call it when you are trying to get something off of someone that's like crushing them, and so like you create sort of like a counter, and then you like leverage like a little thing.
Called.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
But I know.
Yeah,
I think so.
Like we learned like that
I
sort
think
of stuff.
They do some of it in this episode, don't they?
Yeah, Hen was trying to do some with our dear fallen Russ from the 221. But
R.I.P. Russ.
That's just what I was thinking of during this scene. It was like taking me back. So I'm like, oh, they're doing some like like community engagement stuff, and it's like, wow. I wonder if May is gonna get her like her EMT license or something like that after this.
Yeah.
How fun. But Harry has a moment because there's this presumably autistic young man who.
Yeah, it seems like that's what they're.
Yeah.
Coding him as.
He went to the church because his mom said to go there when things got bad, and so he's waiting for her, and Harry like comes and talks to him and says and like offers to like help him out and sort of wait with him together. And yeah, it's like it's like a really nice moment of like Michael like putting his kids to good use, essentially.
And we go back to Michael and like the church ladies talking to, and she's like, you have great kids or whatever. And it's true. Mm-hmm. It's like clearly they just are good kids and know to just like go start helping. And, you know, they're not like being grouchy about having to help out or whatever.
Yeah.
They're just going for it. And the woman is like, you know, can I pray with you or whatever? And they do. And it's a nice moment. And again, it's kind of like that thing of nice that they get to have some or that they're able to depict like some positive religious stuff without the show being like a Christian show. Like we talked about in the season one finale. Just one of those nice moments.
Yeah, it's really nice. And then we cut from that sort of place of like, you know, it's like very... wholesome, it's community oriented, you know, God is present and everything. To hell. We cut to hell. Eddie
and Allie and spinal injury guy are getting out through the elevator shaft.
God is not in this elevator shaft.
Yes.
This is
because suddenly there's an aftershock.
Yeah.
There's an aftershock. And one of the things this does is it causes the elevator, which is like, you know, a few hundred feet above all of them, to start, you know, falling rapidly, coming right towards them. As we heard in the earlier scene, Eddie estimates that it weighs like 2,500, maybe 3,000 pounds. This thing is just hurtling towards them.
Allie and, is like right on at the last minute. Buck's back, like hold on tight, spider monkey style. And like I just wrote down like Allie living my dream, Loki. Like I like just like getting to hang on to Buck's.
It's like your dream and your nightmare.
I know, but like if I had nightmare, but if I had like Buck's like soothing soft presence to like help me through it, I feel like I would make it through.
You would get over your phobia.
I would get over my phobia. I would, you know.
Well, yes. So Buck's like Eddie, kick in the door. Buck's like Eddie, kick in the door, and he does. And like right at the very last second, Buck and Allie manage to get into this door. Yeah. And the elevator comes hurtling right to where they just were, like a millisecond after they get inside. So that is scary.
Yeah. Meanwhile, downstairs, the garage was like looking like it might collapse for a minute there. Mm-hmm. But everyone survives.
But Bobby and Chimney have been like trying to kind of move rubble to get Hen out. And then this aftershock kind of undoes all of the work they just did.
Can we talk about how Bobby and Chimney have had nothing to do all episode?
Yes. They finally get a little something in the final act. But like throughout these two episodes, they've been functionally useless.
They've been in one place doing the same thing for like an hour. And they've had I feel like we haven't had much of a reason to check in on them because it's just like, oh, we're digging through the rubble. Okay, great.
Right.
You know, you know, Hen is like making like a final voice note to Karen in case she dies. Buddy is gallivanting around like the Leaning Tower of L.A. with a diva, you know,
getting almost sliced in twain by an elevator.
And Athena.
It's crazy.
And Athena is like, you know, having her, you know, misadventures in the LAPD, you know.
Right. Athena is girl bossing away price gouging.
Exactly.
As she should.
Meanwhile, you know, Bobby and Chimney are just there like, herk, dirk, dirk, we might get these rocks out of the way if we keep pushing at it.
Well, yeah, back to somebody who's actually doing shit of note. Hen is following Paisley and she finds Kat, the little girl. Kat, not to be confused with dog.
Yes.
Kat is alive. She's uninjured, luckily.
That was so stupid.
Hen gives her back her shoe. The same joke I made in the previous episode.
I know, and it's so funny.
And yeah, it's a nice moment because like Kat appears to be around Denny's age and you know, Hen's just so happy to have found this girl and that she's okay. But, you know, despite this happy moment, when we cut back to Bobby and Chim, the incident commander orders them to evacuate. She's like, that last aftershock made the whole structure unstable. It's not worth it. We got to get you guys out.
Yep.
Bobby's like, I still have one more firefighter in there. She's like, I don't care. Get out of there. So Bobby tells everybody else to evacuate. And then he's like, Chimney, we are staying here. Like, I couldn't let anybody else risk their lives, but we're going to find Hen.
Can I ask a question?
Hmm.
Presumably the other fire captain is with the 221, right?
I'm not sure.
I guess maybe one is, or maybe she's the fire marshal, and then like the other like crews are there too. The 221, are they not concerned for their guy that's missing as well?
They probably are, but
because we know
that's like a whole other show that we're not getting to witness, you know?
I know, because like we
just
know
the
Russ
curated
is
drama
dead
of the 118.
We know Russ is dead, but they don't. And so like if there's two firefighters that are missing in action, you would think that
it is weird that they're talking like there's only one.
Yeah, and like you'd think that there would be that Russ is maybe they hate him or something. Maybe they're just like they were waiting for their opportunity to leave him.
Thank God that guy is dead.
You know, but like they just cleared the fuck out of there, and then Bobby and Chimney were the only ones that stayed initially.
Maybe because Russ came in on his day off, they literally don't even know that he is there.
He clocked in, but he didn't tell anyone. He's like, "Hey guys,
that would suck.
I'm here too."
If that was the circumstance under which he died.
Oh God.
But, you know, they decide to stay. And I wrote down,
gone and
you know,
forgotten.
Bobby has this quote where he says, we're going to make it through this, Chim. Just you and me. And I wrote down, Chobby moment.
Chobby moment.
Chimby. And they decide to do this fun little activity where, you know, they get through to, like, this other part of the parking garage. And there's, like, a layer of cars and garage cement that have like formed into this very dense wall that's basically separating them from Hen. And they're like, you know, how are we going to get through this? They find all the valet keys and they're like, maybe we can move some of these cars or maybe we can find some supplies in some of these cars. So they start opening trunks. I thought it was really funny that every single car they open just happens to have really useful supplies. Like they open, like the first trunk they open, they're like, okay, there's a toolbox and like a bunch of rope. They open another one. It's like another toolbox, more supplies. I thought it would have been really funny. Like if I had been writing this episode, I think the first couple cars should have had like totally weird, random, useless crap in them. Like, you know, oh, this one's just full of roller skates. This one's got somebody's skis in it. This one's got like a sex doll in it. Yeah, I don't know.
A spare tire. Oh, 12 hammers. Great. Tote bags from the downtown shopping area. Fantastic. Oh, a signed souvenir Mickey Mouse portrait from Disneyland. This will help us get out of this sticky situation.
A bunch of merchandise from the Wax Museum, you know. All the Hollywood merch.
A 3-day-old turkey leg from Universal Studios Harry Potter. Right.
This one's just full of Harry Potter merchandise.
Right. And no, yeah, that is a good observation that they just so happen to find the perfect amount
of cars
that just have all of the supplies that they need.
Like, I know it's not uncommon for a car to have like a few car tools in them, like a jack or whatever, but like a whole toolbox in like two separate cars and they're the two first cars they look in seems rather fortuitous.
There was one little moment that I thought was like clever, that they find chains, that like the kind of like chains that you would like put on your tires to like go through snow or whatever. I'm like, that I could totally see being in a car. You know what I mean?
True. Do you think that car belonged to like a serial killer and that was like the chains that they were using to like chain up their victims?
Well, what was that Always Sunny bit with Dennis and like he starts digging through the back of his car? They're like, Dennis, what is all this? He's like, tools. I have all this stuff. They're like, what is it for? Bondage shit, man. Bondage. I like to bind. I like to be bound. maybe the chains belong to Dennis Reynolds is what I'm trying to say.
Well, right, that could have been another thing, is like they open one trunk and it's like covered in blood. There's like a bloody knife, a human foot.
Athena, when we're done here, you might want to get down here. We have something for
take
you.
Take a look at this.
Basically, they find a chimney. He does something this episode. He finds a pickup truck, like a Ford pickup, with a Utah license plate, presumably belonging
to
a Mormon.
Yeah, they really focus on the Utah license plate for some reason.
It's a Mormon pickup truck. This is where they do all the missionary work. They're basically going to, like, I guess, like, tow hook, like, you know, to, like, the back of, like, the truck and, like, just yoink a bunch of the fucking, like cement and shit out of there. They're gonna like tie the chain to like one of the other cars and just try and like get it out of the wreckage. And they do that and it works for a bit, but then the chain snaps, of course. Bobby thinks that they made a wide enough hole to like maybe squeeze through or like work with, and who the hell should roll up but these fucking guys.
Buck and Eddie show up. I wrote in my notes, Buck and Eddie show up, 2 exclamation points. Yay.
Buddy.
That's what I would say if they
Yay.
Yay. But then everybody else shows up, like including the incident commander. And she says, your people are very persuasive and persistent. And I thought that was funny because I love in TV shows when somebody just takes an opportunity to like tell us how awesome our main characters are.
Yeah. It's like they're a like pain in Teen the Wolf. Ass, but we love them for it, you know?
Like on Teen Wolf when they were always being like, wow, Scott McCall is the coolest and most amazing and brave alpha ever to exist. And you're like, why are you telling me that? and like here, I think it's funny when they're like, wow, the 118, now that's a special firehouse. And it's like, yep, okay.
Sure is. Sure is. I mean, listen, at least, like, unlike with Scott McCall, which, listen, I don't subscribe to the term Mary Sue. I think it's a dumb term that is, you know, is misused very wildly and is heavily politicized in a way that is, you know, unhelpful to actual discourse about sort of, like, you know, protagonists and, like, narratives and, like, their roles in the narrative and all that stuff. So I don't like the term. But if ever there was a case to be made about a blatant Mary Sue in a popular property, it's got to be Scott McCall, right?
We can't get into this right now.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay.
I'm right. It's okay.
You are. And I respect that.
Thank you. But yes, the other firefighters show up. They say the 118 is the best firehouse to ever exist, and we love them. So we're going to help you get your diva back.
They were just so awesome and epic that they convinced us to come back here.
Exactly. And if they fuck this up, this is going to be their tomb. You know, if it is all...
Well, they say...
You know, if it collapses...
They say... they have a line where they say, no one's coming to rescue us. And I wrote, I guess you could say...
Help is not coming.
I guess help picked the wrong day to come. Anyway, then
the wrong
they clear a path, and it's like sort of a moment of uncertainty looking into the darkness. Paisley runs out leading the charge. It's like this harbinger of Hen. And, you know, Hen gets through with Kat, and it's a big triumphant moment. I thought it was really cute the way Buck hugged Hen. He was really hugging her.
Yeah, he loves her. He loves her so much.
He does. And I love how, like, Oliver Stark and Aisha Hines love each other. Like, they're so obsessed with each other.
So sweet. It's so sweet.
It is.
They have such a sweet friendship. I love those two. I could watch them in anything, like, honestly. I hope they do more projects together after this. I just hope that they continue to work together.
They should start a podcast.
I would listen to the fuck out of their podcast, okay? Because I don't know if you've, like, listened to, like, interviews with Aisha Hines, but she's, like, wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, like, I could listen to her talk all day.
They're both pretty funny.
Oliver, I struggle a little bit more to listen to. To be honest.
Is it because of his weird accent?
Because his accent is weird and fucked up. Wow. I'm sorry.
Wow. Do you want us to ever be able to have an actor from the show guest star on this podcast or not? We've already said so many weird things about Oliver Stark. I feel like he's never going to be on our podcast.
That's definitely true. I think Oliver's not even my dream guest at this point. I think Ryan is, just because I want to see what kind of really weird shit we could get him to say.
I feel like he's even less likely to come on this podcast, to be honest. But, you know, we can always dream. Then we get back to Maddie at the dispatch. The LAFD guy comes back and he walks towards her. You can see the kind of uncertainty in Maddie. Like, is he going to come to tell me my loved ones are safe or that they're dead or whatever?
Yeah.
But he comes up and says, all members of the 118 are accounted for. And she hugs him. And then she just sits back down. I wrote in my notes, she gets back to slaying.
She gets back to
slaying. What I meant by that is she just sits right back down and takes another 911 call because she's a professional.
This 911 call, this is one of those... Sorry, I hate to interrupt you. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
This 911 call is honestly... weirdly one of my favorites in the entire show. It's so simple.
This is a wonderful moment.
I really love this one. It's this lady calls 911 and she's very concerned about this weird light that's in the sky above LA. She's like, what is it? Is it a UFO? Is it radiation? Is it like, what could it be? And Maddie asks, is there power in your area? She's like, no, there's been rolling blackouts. And she goes, I think you're seeing our galaxy. You know?
Yeah, you're seeing the Milky Way.
So this moment, I'm pretty sure this moment was based off of a really real thing that happened. There was a major blackout in LA. Basically, the entire city went dark for, I want to say, like, almost a full day. And when nightfall came, because there was no more light pollution and it was a clear night, everyone in the city saw the Milky Way galaxy for the first time in basically their entire lives. And 911 dispatch got literally hundreds of calls. Like, asking about, that's like, wild. The crazy lights in the sky. And it's, like, one of those, like, really, like sweet, like, human moments of connection with Maddie and this random woman about, like, seeing...
Yeah, the woman, the you know, gets kind of embarrassed. She's, like... You can tell she's, like, a pleasant person over the phone. She's, like, oh, geez, like, now I feel embarrassed. And She's like, oh, and you must be so busy. And Maddie says, it's been a day. And the woman thanks her for all she does. And then they hang up. And Maddie's kind of like got tears in her eyes again.
Yeah.
But they're like tears of joy this time of the human spirit.
Yeah. That little 911 call, I love it so much because, you know, this was our first real two-part sort of event episode. And like it's like this sort of this gauntlet of like challenges and like trauma is happening. And uncertainty and like danger and people think they're gonna die. People do die. And then you get to this like last little moment. It's like the sort of the green field at the end of like the dark chasm. You emerge and it's like a moment of peace after like the gauntlet of troubles and everything. And yeah, it's like it's almost like a checkpoint. You know, it's like a save room for sure. In like a video game. I love that moment for that reason.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we kind of see back at the scene of the hotel collapse, like they start to play Heroes by David Bowie.
Yes.
Heroes by David Bowie, Needle Drop, cut into a montage. And I was, this is the moment where you're like, yeah, fuck yeah. I love this. It's like such a satisfying needle drop. Mm-hmm. Such satisfying montage. We kind of see, oh, Buck sits down next to Allie. And you're like, ooh, yeah, their sparks are flying. We see, of course, the kid getting reunited with her family.
Yeah, that dad, the basketball team. You know, that dad who was being a huge pain in the ass now has a bright smile on his face. He's like, my daughter's back. And it's like, oh.
Uh-huh.
It's okay. It's okay. You are forgiven.
The basketball team is like praying for their guy.
Mm-hmm.
Dead guy Russ gets like paraded out by his team. Yep. Everybody's like saluting. I thought that was like genuinely emotional.
It was. It was genuinely emotional. It was really sweet.
We see Buck text Maddie back and he's like, you know, I'm fine. And he says, he texts her, proud of you, sis.
Aww.
Which I found funny for no reason.
I thought it was so sweet, though. It was so sweet.
There's just something. I guess I was picturing sis in like the sort of like gay Twitter way. And I thought that was funny. I was picturing him texting Bobby, like, proud of you, sis.
That was so like gay Twitter, like brain rot pilled. That was like on the level of like, it's giving season. It's.
Yeah.
Well, diva.
We see Athena reuniting with her kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we see Hen reuniting with her family.
And she brought the dog.
She brought Paisley with her in her duffel bag, which is so funny.
It's like she smuggled Paisley out of that scene.
Yeah. Right.
Into her house.
Paisley, as we know, Paisley's owner
got smushed.
Entitled woman is no longer with us. So.
Yeah. Diva down.
What choice did she have?
Yeah, it was that or the pound, honestly.
Diva down.
Then we see the basketball team finally, back at the hospital. They're signing Jeff's cast, right?
Uh-huh. And all is well. And finally...
Buddy seeds.
Buddy moment, okay? Because... inexplicably, I'm sorry, but this is another one of those moments where I'm like, how, just like Eddie's intro, I'm like, how did they think this was gonna come off?
Yeah.
If not gay?
How is this not intentional?
Buck has driven Eddie to Christopher's school.
Yeah.
And Eddie like runs in slow motion and he's hugging Christopher. Christopher's so happy. Eddie's so happy.
Yeah.
Cut back to Buck still in the car, just like looking at this scene with like this little fond smile on his face. It's like, okay, is this normal for like two guys who just met and are like platonic work friends?
Yeah.
Is this normal?
My face when I'm seeing my future husband and my future adopted child reunite for the first time.
So it's our first time we are seeing Buck, not even meeting Chris, but like his first time seeing Chris.
Yeah. And there's like already this sort of like warm sort of like look of like, you know, paternal.
He loves both of them.
Like on his face. And it's like, it's so sweet. It's like, oh my God. There is a reason... I'm sorry, it needs to be said. There is a reason Buddy happened, and there is a reason Buddy has become as big as it has, and it is entirely the show's fault.
It is.
Entirely the show's fault. I will not stand for anyone, like, trying to gaslight, you know, us about this, let alone trying to gaslight anyone else about this, saying we're delusional, or saying that we're reading too much into things. This is the first time that Buck has ever seen Christopher, and he drove Eddie to pick him up, and then he, like, it's a slow zoom
in. Does
Eddie,
like, not have his own car? Like, that was an intentional choice.
And then it's a slow zoom in on Buck's face, watching them reunite, and it's like, it's like breaking him out of his funk about his Abby thing. And it's like, I'm sorry, you can kiss a thousand... you know, girls in bars. Like, you know, you can have as many Allies and Ana Flores's and Marisol's and Taylor Kelly's as you want. You boys are co-parenting this child together. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's crazy. And I was just thinking, like, you know, we see, like, Athena reuniting with her family. We see Hen reuniting with her family. If they wanted to, they could have just shown Buck, like, coming home to Maddie, right?
Yeah.
We could have seen, or, like, coming to the dispatch and they hug or something, right?
Yeah.
And instead, they made the very, they could have had Eddie drive to the school by himself, right?
Yeah.
And they made the deliberate choice to, like, unite all of these people in this specific way. So, yeah, it's just one of those other things. Like I said, similarly to Eddie's introduction where I'm, like, baffled at it not being intentionally romantic.
It's insane.
Ostensibly.
No, it's just absolutely insane. It really makes you wonder how people see anything else in this, let alone, like, how they've deluded themselves into thinking that this relationship is entirely heterosexual. Like, I'm sorry, go
right.
back to the source.
I certainly won't defend, like, the behavior of every buddy shipper, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I also will not stand for anybody saying that, like, they're delusional in terms of shipping buddy at all, right?
I see a lot of, like, comparisons
online.
It's
delusional online to not ship buddy, okay? Can I just say that?
No, T. I've seen a lot of comparisons online between Buddy and Destiel. And let me say, Destiel was never this explicit.
And Destiel, and that's saying something. Like, there was a lot.
There was a lot that was really explicit with Destiel. And it was never this explicit.
It was nowhere near this.
Three episodes into one of the characters existing. Like, I'm sorry. It blows your mind. Because, like,
it does.
How could you watch this and read it as anything else? I don't get it.
But anyway.
I'm sorry. I'm talking in circles. Yeah.
We digress.
But
Athena
Buddy sees
is back at home.
Bethina at the Grant household.
Yes, Bethina moment. Yes. Athena has gotten home. You know, Michael's preparing dinner when Athena gets a call from Bobby. And he's like, I really need to see you. And she says, well, you know, I have to cook for the kids. I have to be there for them right now. And he says, I really need to see you. Can you come out front? And I feel like you see almost a little bit of, like, apprehension in Athena, where she's like, is this, like, something serious? Like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
But she gets out front. Bobby has, he just needed to see her after this hard day and this huge disaster. He's come to her house and, you know, he said, I thought about knocking on the door, but I didn't want this to be the first time I meet your kids. So they kind of have their little moment. They reunite and, ooh, Bobby says he likes her outfit, which was a good detail.
Very sort of a sweet moment. Like, you came all this way just to see me? And very funny moment.
He's like,
that
well,
is,
yeah, Athena, he's your boyfriend.
He's your boyfriend. He'll do that. He would have walked if he had to.
She's so not used to, like, having a boyfriend who is in love with her.
I know. And then, speaking of...
yes.
Michael, the gay best friend, comes out and starts interrogating Bobby. He's like,
well, yeah,
can I
first
help
you think maybe, like, he's mad.
Yeah.
He's like, what's all this silliness out here? But then he's like, you, like, Athena, you have him standing out here when I'm, like, making dinner. And
look
Bobby's
at the,
like,
think
oh,
about
no,
the
really,
day he's had, you know?
Right. He's like, oh, I really couldn't impose. And Michael's like, I already set you a place and the kids are excited to meet you.
That's so her gay best friend. That's her gay best friend.
Yeah. He's, like, basically being a wingman now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice Bobby, Athena, Michael moment where, okay, they're all gonna, they're inviting Bobby in. This is the beginning of his relationship with the family at large.
Yeah. I really love
nice
this
moment
for Athena and Michael specifically, because it's like it's like them reaching the relationship that they sort of really, like, worked hard to get to. You know what I mean? It's like solidifying that, because, like, now Athena's in this new relationship. Michael's finding out about it for the first time, and not only is he totally cool and supportive, but he's, like, actively encouraging it and, like, getting it moving.
Yeah. And I was happy for Bobby too, because he, you know, having felt so rejected in episode one by Athena, like kind of being ashamed of him, not wanting to show him off in her life. I thought it was nice that, again, like Michael kind of helps her overcome that like personal shame or like the apprehension to really have Bobby enter her life. And he's like, you know, helping. It's good that Bobby gets to be a part of more of her life now.
Yeah, definitely. And so you love to see it, and that's where the episode leaves us. That's where it ends.
That is.
It ends on this very hopeful, wonderful moment with Bethina going strong, Maddie doing a good job, everyone's alive, and most importantly, Buddy Seeds.
Most importantly, I wouldn't even call it Seeds, but the beginning of Buddy's co-parenting of a child.
Yeah.
And Hen and Karen have a dog now, so that's big.
They have a dog now. The Except lesbians finally have a dog.
I'm not sure we ever hear mention of this dog again, except for like a one-off line in season 6 where they mention that the dog has died.
Oh no!
There's like a different dog at that point in the show, and they're trying to foist it off on Hen, and she's like,
she's like, my last dog died or something like that. Right. Okay. Well, at least that got one more mention than the Bobby blood donation story.
True. We're not gonna let that go.
No, we're not. Are you kidding me? He has this like golden blood that saves thousands of children. How could you let that go? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
But overall, I thought it was a great episode.
Yeah,
Lots of good moments.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the heroes montage.
Very triumphant. And honestly, I don't really think there was like a weak segment of this episode. I think the only thing that I would say that was maybe weak about this episode was how underutilized Chimby was for most of it.
Right. But we got some Chimby crumbs in the end.
We did. And we got a really good Bobby scene at the end of it as well.
Yes.
So,
but yeah,
can't really complain.
Chimney still not getting much. But again, like I said, I think the next episode is very Chimney heavy. So we'll get there.
Yeah. So that'll be good for us. Yeah. Any other final reflections on this episode or things you're maybe looking forward to this season?
I kind of want us to wrap up this recording session. I'm going to be honest with you. We've been on the phone for so long.
We have.
So I'm going to say, good episode. And that's where I'm leaving it.
I think that's a great place to leave it. So listen, kids, remember to spay and neuter your friends and neighbors. And, you know,
wait.
Thanks for listening to the First Risk Podcast. Find us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds.
Why did you just say that?
Do you remember on, I think it was on The Price is Right. The host would always, no, it was on Family Feud. Bob Barker would always say, remember to, spay or neuter your pets. You know, like to control the pet population.
Okay, this is a deeper cut than I was prepared for.
I'm sorry. Were we not all up on the Bob Barker lore?
What the fuck? I've never watched an episode of Family Feud that was not hosted by Steve Harvey.
Yeah, he doesn't.
I'm sorry. You've out cultural referenced me.
Wow. He doesn't. Yeah, I guess Steve Harvey isn't giving the pet PSAs either.
I guess not.
Wow.
But why would you say your friends and neighbors instead of pets?
Listen.